From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in September of 2020, when then-President Donald Trump made a prediction. He made a number of predictions, in fact, which were really more like warnings. Elect Joe Biden, Trump said, and the stock market will turn to dust. You will not be able to afford a gallon of gas. You will face financial ruin. First, here was Trump talking about gas prices at one of his rallies.
If Biden got in, you'd be paying $7, $8, $9. Didn't they say, get rid of your car?
$8, $9 gasoline. All right. Then there was Trump at one of his presentations on the economy that year.
It will be a terrible, terrible sight. It might even be a 1929 situation. So you have a chance to have the greatest numbers in history. You're almost there. We're almost back to where we were from the standpoint of the stock market. Think of that. But you'll have a crash like you've never seen before. You put the wrong person in office, you'll see things that you would not have believed are possible.
A 1929 stock market coming our way. Another Great Depression, he promised. And then something strange happened. When gas did not go to $9, and when the stock market kept breaking all-time record highs, Trump didn't backtrack. Now, he said the reason that things were so good is that the market hated the president, President Biden, but it just believed that Trump was coming back. So everything was humming. But be careful, Trump warns again 4 years later. This time it's for real. This time gas will go to $8 or $9 or $10. This time the market really will crash if a Democrat wins. You just watch. Well, over to Lesko Advisors, economist Eric Morris isn't someone who prognosticates on politics, much the opposite. Morris tries not to be affected by political noise. And instead, he wanted to see what actually happens when we elect a Republican or a Democrat. And this is not about Donald Trump or Joe Biden or any one person. In fact, he wanted to look over decades. What does happen to the markets? What happens when one party is in control of power historically or the other? What does history tell us? And I thought his analysis was not only interesting, but valuable as we head for what I think will be 4 horrible months of the loudest political noise possible. So I invited Dr. Morris to come back to Connections to give us a dose of economic reality. He is not here picking political sides. He is offering real data and analysis over time. Eric Morris is staff economist at Alesco Advisors. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan. Happy to be here as always.
And I have to say, I think Donald Trump is probably among the more hyperbolic of predictors. When you say 1929 is coming, you know, that's pretty dire. But there's always a political warning that politicians do. You know, don't elect me and things are going to fall apart. So why did you decide to really dig into this now?
Well, the real impetus for my analysis was the fact that the clients we work with on a regular basis are really concerned about what's going on right now. It's hard to open up any news source, whether it's print or digital or listen on the radio, watch on TV, without really being bombarded by election coverage and election news. And elections are important in the U.S. They're always important. Presidential elections hold a special importance in our republic. And this particular presidential election seems wildly important, particularly the candidates and the pundits that are out there are putting this up on a pedestal of being possibly the most important election of a generation, of a lifetime, maybe in the history of our country, a lot of people are saying. So that level of importance made me want to do some research for our clients. On top of the importance, though, is this level of uncertainty. Not every election has been so uncertain as the one we have right now. In fact, being a person who's consuming the news, there is an uncertainty as to whether the candidates right now, as they're presented, will be the candidates come November on the ballot.
Yeah.
And so that degree of uncertainty combined with the level of significance that's being assigned to this creates angst among people, in particular our clients. And I wanted to research that for our clients and provide some real objective information as to what we have seen and what we haven't seen in the past when it comes to the data regarding market performance and political parties of the president, the composition of government at any given time, and also just the simple timing of the fact that we're having a presidential election this year. What does that mean compared to other years in terms of market performance?
So if there is one headline, and there's many, and we're going to work through Eric's research, and we're going to talk about not only what he found, but then we're going to talk about the whys. But I want to start with the headline for me is that the markets and the economy is pretty resilient to whoever gets elected. In fact, all of this talk about a crash or the greatest thing ever, the market is paying attention, I'm sure. I mean, the market is ultimately people making decisions. But it's pretty steady in the face of a lot of political turmoil.
Yeah, when we talk about the stock market and you talk about that resilience, you're probably zooming out a little bit and looking at over the course of weeks, months, years being resilient. Obviously, in markets, in the stock market in particular, they don't move in straight lines. The stock market, particularly over the short run, can bounce up and can bounce down based on a number of factors. Elections are just one of many, many, many factors that could push a market in the short term up or down. But the baseline to think about is the fact that, yes, markets have been resilient, and that when it comes to the things that people are concerned about, whether their party wins the presidency or not, whether their party is has unified control in Congress and can get the legislation they favor through, maybe they're concerned about just the timing of the election in general, none of these things have a discernible impact. They don't have a real pattern that we can actually see as a signal on markets, that markets will perform a certain way if there is a certain outcome. By that, I mean, if a Republican is elected president, no one can say what the outcome will be in the stock market. And the same thing with the Democrat.
Just because it's a Republican
Just because it's a Republican or just because it's a Democrat. Those are not signals by which people can use to predict what will happen with markets. Predicting what markets will do in general is just a real fool's errand, other than the fact of making a long-term investment in banking on the productivity and the economic engine of the U.S., society. But if you are looking for those short-term signals, you're looking in the wrong place if you're looking at the political party of the president.
Okay. And you went back how long to collect data?
So this is a really good question, Evan. The data was actually available through 1929, which is an interesting year there.
Interesting year.
I actually only rewound to 1960 and 61 in those years. And the reason why, it was a very intentional decision. When I was looking at elections, I wanted to have comparable comparisons, it's redundant, but I wanted to have comparisons that were relatively reasonably similar to today. And for those who are students of presidents and presidential elections, they'll know that the election of 1960 holds a really important place when we think about modern elections. It was the first election in which there was a televised debate. And that televised debate, for those that are students of history, was between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon. And it had a real significant impact on the outcome of that election. So I chose that year as my starting point because that was really, in my mind, and I think in the mind of many historians, the first real modern election, and that has had a big influence on today. So I went back to 1960, and I looked at the market performance. And when I say market, I'm looking at the entire U.S. stock market. So that's not just the S&P 500 index, which is a popular thing to follow, which is the largest 500 companies, give or take, in the U.S. stock market. It's not just the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is even a narrower index.
30, right?
That's right. It's a much narrower index. I looked at the entire U.S. stock market and how it performed during those periods going back to 1960.
And I want to say to listeners who may be wanting to email me and say, hey, the stock market is not the whole of the economy. And that's correct. That is fair. We are looking at a piece of analysis on a major portion, but not all of the economy. And it is simply a way of understanding. This kind of rhetoric throughout presidential campaigns, does it turn into reality? What can we glean or learn from it? And what is the U.S. stock market return by administration? What is it? What does that look like? So, I'm looking at some of your data here, and let me just look at U.S. stock market returns by administration first. Here, you write that market performance has been mostly agnostic to the political party of presidents. The average annual return has been 13% under a Democrat, 10% under a Republican, both quite good by any reasonable measure. And it's notable that the average return under Republicans is pulled down by the negative returns during the administrations of Nixon and George W. Bush. And when you look at the chart in bar graph form here, Ford's got the biggest return. interestingly, I think it's probably Obama and Trump and Biden. I mean, Clinton. Like, the modern stock market has done very well in the last 30 years.
That's right.
But then the two that really are below the line, the negative lines, are Nixon and George W. Bush. And you note that there were external forces that were at play there. Do you want to describe those first?
Sure. And before I even get there, I think the message here is that from 1960 to today would have been a great time to be invested in the stock market, really over that whole period, but over most time periods within them would have been a really nice time to be invested. Your returns would have been double digit on an annualized basis. That is just remarkable. That's your money really working for you. I mean, really remarkable. The only two presidents that saw negative average annual returns were George W. Bush and Richard Nixon. And the anomalies of those, as you pointed out, it was really a timing issue. At the end of both of those administrations, you saw really significant bear markets, which is when the stock market goes down by more than 20%. You saw bear markets associated with pretty significant recessions. So for Nixon, this was a recession that started at the end of 1973 and into 1974. It was a recession brought on by the OPEC embargo, the oil crisis that happened, and what ensued was a crash in the stock market, went down, bear market. Nixon resigns in August 1974, and that's the end of his term, and the market was very much down. So you have this negative average annual return because of that. It's been pulled down. George W. Bush, same idea with this phenomenon that occurred. It was the great financial crisis that happened in 2008, tremendous bear market. George W. Bush leaves power, transitions to President Obama in January 2009, and that was at the bottom of a very deep bear market as well. So those two things, the power of the president probably had very little to do with the markets at the time. You know, if it did factor in, it was probably very, very, very low on the list of many, many other things that were going on in markets at the time.
All right. So part of my job is to challenge part of that. So let's argue for a second.
Please.
I don't think it's an argument, but I take the point on Nixon. On George W. Bush, certainly, and I don't remember when Greenspan, was that for most of the aughts? When was Greenspan at the head of the Fed?
Greenspan was at the head of the Fed from the mid-1980s till 2006.
Okay, so it was most of the aughts.
He's actually the longest-serving Fed chair and might be the longest-serving Fed governor. The reason being that Fed governors serve 14-year terms, and they can't serve two. But you can fill out somebody else's term and then start serving your own, which he did. So, and he was the chair the entire time that he was on the board. So Greenspan, really an influential guy. But yes, Greenspan reappointed as chair every 4 years. So he was appointed by Reagan, reappointed by Reagan, reappointed by Bush, reappointed by Clinton, reappointed by George W.
And so I bring up Greenspan because he's not solely responsible for the housing meltdown or the subprime mortgage crisis. I mean, there's a lot of really smart financial scholars who have dug into this much better than I have. But Greenspan certainly did advocate for kind of the ownership society. George W. Bush liked the idea of massively expanding the number of Americans who were not renting but were owning their own homes.
That's right.
And when policy pushes that in a way that banks can exploit, you get the financial. I mean, like, I'm super simplifying here, but you get a financial crisis. How is the president not at least partly involved there?
Yeah, and I understand. I want to kind of zoom big picture instead of talking about the individuals and talk about the fact that policy does have an impact on the economy.
Okay,
and policy can have an impact on markets, but the expected impact of policy that people predict is not always the case. I would argue that Greenspan didn't expect that his policies would have a hand in creating a real estate bubble that would ultimately pop and create a disaster domino effect throughout the global economy. On the flip side of that, I want to use this idea of policy being a signal that people should use to kind of play the stock market in different ways. And one of the things with policy is one of the headline policies I think that Trump and Biden differ on is energy. Joe Biden is very much a supporter of green energy and alternative energy sources and has created policies to try to support those through his Green New Deal or whatever the name happens to be. I know that there was a lot in the Inflation Reduction Act that was supporting green energy businesses. And Donald Trump, for his part, 4 years before then, much more open to the oil and gas industry, certainly taking federal lands and making them not banned to drilling anymore and things like that. During the 4 years of President Trump, somebody might have said, well, Trump's going to favor the oil companies, so oil company stocks are going to go through the roof, and we should put a bet on those and short the green energy companies. Green energy companies saw a return of over 150% during President Trump's term, and oil and gas companies were down. They might say vice versa for Biden and say, well, Biden's going to keep that momentum going, so we better bet on green energy.
And you know, and Democrats, they don't want to drill. Sure,
exactly, not on oil and gas. Yep. The relationship was inverse. Oil and gas companies so far throughout the Biden administration have returned outsized performance compared to the broad market, and green energy companies have floundered. So this is, it's one of those things that policies do matter, but when it comes down to having the expected effect on markets that you think, sometimes it doesn't happen. Sometimes it does. But this is one of those highlight marquee cases that I think is a real, it presents cognitive dissonance, meaning that it really bends people's minds thinking about the fact that this was a reality over these past 4 years. And it should be said, by the way, it's really interesting. We have these two candidates right now for president. Almost never do we have two we have to go back over 100 years to have two candidates for president where you actually have case studies from their first terms. Right, you have two candidates. You've seen their 4 years. And by the way, if you look at that chart and look at the positive returns of the stock market under Trump and the positive returns under Biden, you know, if you're looking for a signal there, which I would suggest not to be looking for, both pretty darn good.
What was the last one? Teddy Roosevelt was on the
ballot? You got Teddy Roosevelt. He wasn't a major party candidate at the time of his election.
The Bull Moose Party?
1912. Bull Moose Party, the Progressive Party, Bull Moose. Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt's has a soft spot in my heart. He's one of my favorite figures in all of history. But really, when you think about Cleveland and McKinley, that was a really that election was two people who had served as president with two major party tickets.
Politics was so different back then. It was so much more dignified. That's how we got chants like "There ain't no flies on us, Bull Moose." It was very dignified in 1912. Everything old is new again. So I want to hang on the oil and green question for one more second here.
Sure.
Do we know why? By the way, here let me pose an idea, and you tell me if there's anything to
this.
Does the effect on markets lag by a certain amount of time, policy and approach? And if so, is that part of the explanation?
It can lag. Sometimes it takes a while for policies to work their way through. But I think the explanation is probably less about what happened and more about people's expectations not being met. And the expectations are because we hear about policies as these headline things, but policies are simply nudges. And sometimes a nudge can push people up a mountain or down a cliff, but other times a nudge just, you know, changes, has a slight change in direction and not much. There are market forces that are vast and broad that are acting to create these outcomes. And the policy nudges that are happening are much, much smaller in terms of guiding where the market will ultimately end up. At least in that case, sometimes there are major policy decisions that can have more winner and loser extremes in terms of industries. But in this case, for all of the headlines that it's been making, it just wasn't the case.
And can you give us the abridged, put on your professor hat notes version of how you would describe what did cause the housing crash, the financial crash of 07-08?
Yeah, it was a confluence of events, many things all happening at once. But what was going on was that the rapidly easing of access to home loans and credits and different types of home loans, having down payments get minimized and banks really having a high incentive to make as many loans as possible, in addition to those loans being taken on the secondary market and bundled into these boutique securities like a bond essentially or a stock essentially that you could invest in, and those securities being layered so thick with different types of investments that no one really knew what was in them. And so when the housing market started to go bust, that was one thing, right? The fact that people were not being able to afford their mortgage payments and that they were getting underwater on their home equity. It wasn't worth their while to continue paying the bank their mortgage. So they were just essentially leaving the keys on the counter and walking out of their homes. And, you know, they foreclosed. The house is the bank's problem now. That was one issue. But that winds up having a domino effect because of the secondary market for those securities. The web of interconnectedness was such that the dominoes fell in every direction and it impacted the whole world. It actually, for a very concise explanation of this, and this is, I get no kickback from this from the movie producers, but the movie The Big Short.
I was just going to ask you that.
Yeah, so there's a guy in it that gives the explanation. His name is Richard Thaler. And you know, Richard Thaler kind of talks about one of the explanations, and that is given by Richard Thaler. Richard Thaler was a guy who got his PhD at the University of Rochester and wound up teaching there for a little bit. Winds up winning a Nobel Prize in 2017 for economics about his work of behavioral economics. But he is in the movie and actually gives part of the explanation for the whole thing. But the movie actually, for as much as it is a fictionalized account of something that actually really happened, they do a nice job of trying to explain what really happened.
The late Anthony Bourdain using old fish to show you what subprime mortgages and then some of those collateralized debt instrument? I mean,
CDOs, collateralized debt obligations.
And how they were composed. So anyway, I was literally going to ask about The Big Short. So it's not perfect, but it's not a bad shorthand to try to understand.
Yeah, okay. Get on YouTube and look for the Big Short's explanation of what happened during the financial crisis.
Let me get Meredith in Rochester on the phone. Hello, Meredith. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to point out that the idea that oil and gas stocks would go down during the Biden administration and should have gone up during the Trump administration and vice versa for green energy is a little bit short-sighted in that it took some time for Trump to make some of his choices. And it seems to me that that type of thing would not happen instantly, right? So the fact that oil and gas have gone up during the Biden administration, I think points to the fact that Trump made changes so that those types of things would happen. Whereas it seems that Biden's Inflation Reduction Act isn't going to have an immediate effect on green energy. I mean, we have to see this stuff play out. Now, if Trump gets in again, obviously he's going to undo as much as he can. But you would see those green energy companies go up if he does get in again because of what Biden did, not necessarily because he's in office. Thank you.
Yeah, Meredith, I'll send it over to Eric. Let me just say, first of all, I think you're making very fair points about how policy, the effects of policy don't get felt in a day, a week, or a month, sometimes not a year. Sometimes it can take the better part of a decade. And that's where the lag that I brought up can come in. But I would say, Meredith, is one of the premises of the research and the reason that we thought it would be interesting to share with our listeners is there's a ton of hype and rhetoric, overheated rhetoric, about if you elect this person, expect in 2025 the market to do this and then adjust accordingly and invest accordingly. And by the middle of 2025, here's what's going to happen. And we're going to be in a recession. And we're going to do this. You're going to hear all kinds of overheated rhetoric. And the idea that you're going to be able to just discern immediately and know where to invest and know exactly what to do, it flies in the face of history, which is that the markets are really resilient to changing presidents, which party is in office, et cetera. It doesn't mean they're not impacted. It takes a while for that impact to be felt. And probably, if you get super granular, there is sort of some kind of way to maybe parse exactly if you go really deep some of these effects. I don't hear Eric saying there's no effect.
That's right.
But I think Meredith's also making some important points.
There are some important points there. And Meredith is onto this fact that we mentioned earlier that sometimes policies do work on a lag, and many policies are actually structured to work on a lag. You know, you might have a program that gets funded and the funding gets voted for in 1 year, but it takes 10 years to carry out. So that spending happens for 10 years. And then in the next 10 years, you see the effects of that spending. So there are all sorts of different types of lagged effects. And Meredith has a point there. I also appreciate that you brought up the fact that what we're talking about is the fact that people are saying that if X happens with the election, then Y will happen next. And, you know, Meredith's point might be more salient, the idea that, like, hey, these things take different amounts of time and there's different policies that come through. But I also would be hesitant to give too much credit to the president even before. I mean, that would say that, you know, much of the stock market returns under Trump would be due to Obama. And I'm sure that a Trump supporter who's using that logic to explain what's going on during the Biden administration wouldn't accept that logic to explain what happened under the Trump administration.
No, it works when the home team is winning.
That's right. That's right. But I think it is, you know, I think it is a fair point to say that it's hard to see these things happening. At the same time, I do want to emphasize, and I know I said this earlier in the show, those policies are probably very low on the list of the market forces that are actually driving what's happening. They could be somewhere in the middle. Some industries might have them closer to the top, but really the market forces of the free market, as opposed to the government policies, which would not be free market, the forces of the free market are far stronger than those regulatory control forces that we're seeing.
It to me lines up with the expectations that people have and then the reality. And I'll give you a WXXI example. Back when Mitt Romney was talking about the funding for NPR, which actually happened at a presidential debate. Can you believe that? You would ask in surveys, Americans were asked, well, how much do you think NPR and public radio is funded by the government? And people are like, well, 80%, 90%. You're like, well, no, it's like, you know, it's anywhere from 12 to 17 cents on the dollar. And it's, and that, by the way, that's significant to us.
Significant.
Yeah, certainly significant. but it's just nowhere close to what's actually going on. Right now, if you ask the average Republican, how has the stock market fared under Biden? The average Republican will tell you, terribly, depression level, worst in decades.
That's right.
And the answer is, it's broken all-time highs. It's been good. If you ask the average Democrat, how did the stock market fare under Donald Trump? They'd be like, well, terrible.
That's right.
You know, I mean, he's only served rich people and people got killed. And I'm not like sort of being flippant here. This is actually based on surveys.
This is based on surveys that people's presidential or the people's political party that they identify with has an influence on how they perceive the economy and the stock market doing, no matter what the reality is, based on who's in power and how they feel about that. What's really interesting, I have some more data here, which was I found to be fascinating, which had to do with approval ratings of presidents and the fact that the approval rating of a president, there's no clear relationship between a high approval rating for a president and high stock market returns. The relationship is all over the place. There's no real coordination there. So even if the majority of Americans are feeling like the president is doing a good job, which right now is not the case, that's not saying that the stock market will do well as a result of that, or that's not saying that the stock market has done well and has informed that. The correlation there just doesn't exist. So it's really fascinating with that as well.
We almost pulled another clip from one of the presidential debates of 2020 in which Donald Trump was talking about the market, and Joe Biden finally jumped in and said, you know, the market is not the American people, and a lot of American people are not in the market, and you should be caring about them too. And the clip, just as an aside, was pretty jarring to me to see the difference in Biden's willingness and sort of capacity to jump in and attack on a point that he thought where there was an opening. But that's for another conversation.
And I will say what I can take from that is that the economy itself is the American people. And the stock market is a component of the economy. They're not the same thing. I've written a lot about this. I talk with this about with clients. And it's a conversation for another place, I think. But with the economy, and you look at the average annual economic growth under these administrations, every administration since 1960 has had positive average growth.
Every administration.
Yeah, has had positive average annual growth.
When we come back from our only break of the hour, here's what we're going to do. There's a separate part of the analysis, which is interesting. It's not just about presidential politics. It's about U.S. stock market returns by party control. And Eric has some analysis there. And I've got some feedback from listeners that I want to read for Eric Morris, who is our guest this hour. He's the staff economist at Alesco Advisors. And Dr. Morris is a frequent guest here talking about the economy and related issues. We're going to post with his permission, we'll post on our show notes a link to his analysis for Alesco Advisors. So we're going to do that and make sure you can have access to that too, listeners. Let's take this break. We'll come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, Friday on The Next Connections. In our first hour, I sit down with Rochester Mayor Malik Evans. We'll have a conversation about a wide range of issues, and we will welcome your feedback and questions for the mayor as well. In our second hour, guest host Eric Logan leads a conversation about something you might have heard of, or maybe this will be the first time you've heard of emotional emancipation circles. Talk with you on Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Steve says, so if presidents don't affect gas prices, who does? Eric Morris. Steve wants to know, who does affect gas prices?
Gas prices are affected by, to put it in simplest terms, the supply and the demand for gasoline. And that's as simple as it gets. From there, it only gets more complicated. When the demand for gasoline is something that is an important input or a vital, it's essential input, the demand for gasoline can be impacted by a slew of number of other things, right? The demand for gasoline goes down for a number of reasons. We saw this during the COVID shutdowns. Demand for gas dropped dramatically. And so that could have an impact on markets. At the same time, you could see a dramatic increase in the market for gasoline. And it really is a global market. There are certainly regional aspects to it. The same thing for supply. When you think about gas supply, which can have a really big impact, I think a lot of the fluctuation you see is a lot more about supply for gasoline than it is for demand. But the supply for gasoline comes from refineries who are refining petroleum. And so the market for petroleum, which would be oil, is a really important input for the market for gasoline. And the costs of refining that gasoline, the cost of transporting it, the cost of getting the oil itself, so the cost of the oil, the cost of removing the oil from the ground, all those things are going to have impacts on the price of gasoline itself. And they all work at once in this really beautifully complex way to determine a price that you pay at the pump. And so all those different factors can have impacts on it. And it's hard to say that any one thing does. Certainly no one person does. Right, no one person can have an impact on that.
So,
and no, I'm the least popular guy in the room. You don't want to invite me to a cocktail party. People don't like talking to me. It's, you know.
So I'm genuinely curious that if you've got clients at Alesco, who back in 2020, maybe their proclivity is they lean conservative or they're voting red, and they hear the president say, "Hey, if you elect Joe Biden, we're gonna have $9 gasoline." Mm-hmm. I mean, you probably would have told them, like, guys, like, no.
Well, with Alesco, it's really, you know, it's a really nice position to be in. We work with about 120 nonprofit organizations, many of which are in our community, endowments, foundations, and the investment committees and boards that represent them. We work with twice as many families, many of them, again, in our community. And the thing that they all have in common with in terms of our wealth management is that they all, for the most part, believe in our philosophy, which is a disciplined long-term look at markets. We're looking over, you know, we're looking at trying to provide for the needs of today, but also for tomorrow and really into the future. And so when you take a longer term look at markets, it doesn't prevent people from feeling that instinctual fear about short term and transient events. And when I say transient, it sounds like insignificant. But no, like an election is very, very significant, but it is also transient, right? It comes and it goes, and it's ephemeral, and its effects will be felt, but time will go on. And as time goes on, as you noted at the top of the show, markets are resilient and our economy has been resilient for a lot more reasons than the people that are elected in power. It's really the frameworks and the institutions of our society, the culture of our society. And so when you take that longer term view and you maintain discipline and you invest in different types of asset classes that you expect to perform differently in different market environments, because no one can be certain what the market environment will be tomorrow. There are a number of things that could change that, and they can change fast. So by having that type of portfolio constructed for our clients and maintaining the discipline that it takes to see that through over years and years as it goes, the nonprofit institutions we work with, the families we work with are better off. And so the longer we work with a client, the more they understand that, I think. And the clients that we do sign on, you know, at least buy into that philosophy as well. So whether they were somebody who was, you know, blue at the beginning of Trump's term and worried about Trump, or red at the beginning of Biden's term and worried about Biden, having those conversations with them is a reminder that markets don't move in straight lines, that short-term fluctuations can happen, they can happen on the downside. But over the longer term, we're really investing in the overall productivity of the U.S. and the global economy.
The one thing that bugs me a lot, there's a lot of things that bug me. I'm going to say one thing. When we really try to prey on fear, I that bothers me. So I don't have a problem with people in politics saying, "I'm worried about what's going to happen to the country if you elect my opponent." That's fine. I mean, you probably are worried. But to tell people you're going to have a 1929 crash, that's a different level.
I think I've said this line on this show before, but the market for fear and for negativity and for pessimism is one that is eternal for humans. We are biologically programmed to assign authority to fear. Things that make us scared grab our attention and we react to them far more than things that make us calm and feel good. And there's lots of social science out there that supports this, and I'd encourage people to dig into that. It's in psychology, it's in behavioral economics, it actually is in biology as well. And so people who are looking to score points with others, oftentimes, whether it's at a cocktail party or at a presidential debate, oftentimes gravitate towards instilling fear or pessimism or negativity because it sounds authoritative. In that sense,
I don't think it brings out the best of us. And
no.
I think there's a lot of legitimate things to be fearful of. But the idea that we'll just choose red or choose blue and we're having 1929 again. Yeah. Dallas wants to know, how much is Biden using the Strategic Petroleum Reserve affected prices?
So The Strategic Petroleum Reserve is a thing that happens. It's the government's stockpile of resources, oil, petroleum resources, that they can tap into at different times. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve is really a drop in the bucket in terms of the overall oil supply of the country and of the globe. I don't want to get too much into political waters here, but it's a nice thing for somebody to say that they're doing if they're looking to score points with people who are hurting. The degree that it has an impact on the market, I'm sure that there are studies that could tell you that X amount of draw on the reserve has X amount of impact on prices, all else equal. All else is never equal. So it's really hard to say what impact that had. But it was a gesture at a time when gas prices were very, very high. And, obviously gas prices are not where they were before. And in fact, in today's inflation report, the energy portion of the index was actually down, which has been a trend more often than not over the past year, year and a half, 2 years. So it's been a good thing.
Rick Moore says the U.S. economy is integrated into global economy. What happens in the rest of the world will influence the economy here.
Rick, you take one of my classes back in the day? That's absolutely true. The global economy, the U.S. is very much a part of the global economy. And so there are a lot of things that the U.S. can control domestically. But in as much as we rely on things from other countries, and we do live in was Thomas Friedman's, the world is flat. We do live in a very flat world these days, meaning that our connections to other countries have increased. That we are a component of the global economy. We are the single largest component of the global economy, and that's by a long shot. But nonetheless, we are impacted by those factors. So, Rick, that's a wise statement. Yeah.
Charles says, Evan, I've been investing is the word. He says, I've been investing since 1982. Mm. I've been through Black Monday in the 80s and every up and down in the market for 42 years. Mm. In the 90s, when my friends pulled their money out when Clinton was elected, they missed the best three-year run ever. Mm-hmm. I hung tough when W. Bush was president and tech and housing crashed. The lesson, it's the one my dad taught me in 1982. Invest and then don't think about it. I just retired 2 weeks ago and we've hit critical mass. It's a lesson I taught my kids and my former students at East. Buy and hold. It's a marathon, not a sprint. Love the show.
More wisdom here. That would be pretty solid personal financial advice, is to buy and hold. You don't want to do so indiscriminately. We obviously, with the clients we're working with, we buy things very, very much intentionally, and we are monitoring that what we're buying and holding for them on a regular basis and making changes as necessary as we see through our analysis. But really, for an everyday investor, buying a broad index fund and that's low cost, that gives you market exposure, holding it for a long period of time, continue to contribute to it over periods of time, that's yielded pretty significant results. So kudos to Charles for that.
Joe says, in my opinion, the stock market is just legalized gambling. And of course, there are people in power who are privy to insider trading.
Mm-hmm. That's a cynical view. But I will comment on it. There are portions of the market that there are instruments out there that exist that allow people to treat the stock market more as bets. But when you're buying a stock or an index fund, a fund of companies, you're actually buying the companies themselves. And I would encourage people to treat that as an investment, not a bet. Is the fact that you're investing in a productive asset, you are giving capital and making capital available to companies that are out there making goods and providing services that have a real value. I would say the opposite of that, and we don't need to go down into this rabbit hole, though, it would be like Bitcoin. I hear people saying they're investing in Bitcoin. I think that that's a contradictory statement. There's nothing productive about that at this point. There's nothing produced by it. There's no service provided. And that's probably a whole nother show, Evan. You can invite me on to talk about that. I'd be happy to.
Of all the things we've talked about, I really haven't gone deep with you on.
No, we should.
On crypto,
we should talk crypto sometime. Save a show for it. That'd be fun. Maybe I'll write something about it for you, and we can talk about it. But what I want to translate to this to say, if you do invest in, let's say, a green energy company, think about like an electric car company, like Rivian, right? One of my favorite ones to watch. It's a really interesting company making trucks and SUVs. if you're investing in, if you're buying Rivian stock, you're giving capital to Rivian that would be able to help them be more productive and do what they do. If you are going to buy an oil and gas company stock, if you're going to go buy ExxonMobil and you're providing the capital for them to go do what they do. There are ways to bet on the market. There are different types of derivative instruments that you can use and calls and puts and options and things like that. You know, I think for the everyday investor, if you are buying low-cost index funds or you're working with a financial advisor, the way we work with large institutions and many families, investing in really the productivity and the long-term production of the U.S. and global economies, that's not a casino. That's a real productive investment.
Crypto is just democratizing currency.
Evan, we should save it for another show.
Okay. That is a tangent. Will you come back talk about that?
I would be happy to do that anytime for you and the listeners. Yeah.
Okay. You write also about not just the president's impact. I want to read a little bit of what you've written about parties in power. You write, people may expect the president to hold outsized influence over important issues, but the structure of our republic limits what a single president can achieve through checks and balances with Congress. This means the president and Congress must cooperate to pass meaningful legislation. For those with strong partisan beliefs, it may stand to reason that better market outcomes would occur when the federal government is united under their party of choice. Conversely, partisans might expect markets to perform worse when unanimous control is held by the opposing party. And then you include a chart that shows the average annual returns of the U.S. stock market by party composition since 1961. What did you find?
What I found was, first of all, going back to it's the same time period as under those presidents, so we're just slicing and dicing this in a different way. It would be a great time to be invested over that time period. You were talking double-digit returns on your portfolio.
Instead of trying to time the downturns?
Which is impossible to do, and we've talked about that on the show before. So great time to be invested over that time period. If anything, the highest returns come during times of divided government. The highest returns here out of the six different arrangements that took place over the course of that 63-year period, the highest returns were when the party of the president was different than one or both of the parties in control of Congress. And that actually yielded a 14.6% average annual return during those types of divided government times. The unified government was 13.7%, not far behind. But actually, that divided government number is being dragged down quite a bit by the arrangement when there's a Republican president and a Democratic Congress. And I should say not when there is, but when there has been a Republican president and a Democratic Congress. And the reason why that one lags so far behind, that one's actually under 4%, is because during 1973 and 1974 and 2007, 2008, those were the arrangements. And we talked about those earlier in the show. It was a matter of timing on those, on the bear markets that took place associated with the OPEC recession and the Great Financial Crisis recession. So it just happened to be that was the arrangement under that.
So in other words, let me just kind of simplify here. We should not overanalyze what we expect to happen just because one party gains control. And generally, the markets have done pretty well regardless.
Yeah, there's no evidence to support that one person's favored party having control of the government is going to have a better outcome than any other arrangement.
The conclusion that I caution against for myself in reading your piece, and I wonder if you would feel the same way for listeners, is to caution against nihilism here. I mean, this is not an indication that nothing matters.
No, elections are very important. The person in power, I think I start the piece by saying we expect that person to have influence over political, social, economic issues, and they do. The president does have a tremendous influence over those things. The people that are elected in Congress, the representatives, the senators, they have tremendous influence. Down the line, everyone has tremendous influence. It's the fact that that influence is not a signal by which to trade markets on. There is no clear signal, there has been no clear signal given in the past that if a certain party or a certain person or a certain group of people hold power, that markets will do X. There is no data supporting that in the past.
And when it comes to election years themselves, we just saw a UK election in which Rishi Sunak vacated 10 Downing Street the day of the election. You have a new prime minister moving in that night. Meanwhile, we have an election in November. We don't have someone move in until January 20th. We have the longest election ever, which I maybe contributes to the people who are like, well, how are the Democrats replace Joe Biden? It's only 4 months. Meanwhile, France and the UK is like, are you kidding? Canada? 4 months? You could have three elections in 4 months, not just one. What is wrong with you people? But anyway, that's what we do here. And there's this assumption that the markets will go haywire during a presidential election year or behave markedly differently. Mm-hmm. And again, you find not really, huh?
Yeah, not any different than any other time. It's really a... there's a graph on this page, and I would encourage listeners to go to the page, the connections page, and open up this piece so they can see some of these visuals. There's a graph here that represents the market performance from the beginning of August to the end of January for every year from 1960 till today. And it looks at the growth of a potential growth of a dollar during that time period based on the market. And what you see is a sort of shotgun blast starting with a dollar and going all different directions. It's this massive spaghetti of different lines. And those lines reflect all the different years and the performance in the 3 months before and the 3 months after election. I chose that time period because I think that the time in the 3 months leading up to an election is a time, can often be a time associated with great uncertainty. And that typically the morning after election night, you wake up and you kind of have some more certainty about what's going on. And you know the expectations at that point, and really the market is a reflection of people's expectations. The expectations start to get more solidified and congealed between November and then the end of January. And obviously by the end of January, that president has taken the oath of office and is in office. So I selected that six-month time period, but it was important that that same six-month time period I'm looking at during years when there hasn't been a presidential election. Right. So we're looking at all the different years all over time, and I've got them color coded. And as you can see, most of the mess is kind of within a little bit of a band. And the band, there are some dips and whatnot, but it kind of trends upward. And actually, if you look at the averages over time, the average for the market performance during that 6 month period during an election year is positive. And the average for that performance during that 6 month period during years when there wasn't a presidential election is positive. And they're nearly on top of each other. In fact, if anything, the average performance during that time period during election year is slightly higher than the average performance during non-presidential election years. And if you're going to search for an explanation to credit that for, maybe it's the fact that once an election happens, there's a whole new set of expectations and certainty. And markets really don't like uncertainty. Markets try and filter through noise and look for information.
How about optimism? Is there optimism?
Yeah, for probably for half the country at any given time, then the other half, maybe not. it's hard to say, but I would say that expectations start to get clarified and maybe that, you know, they realize, hey, it's four more years of X. So this is what we're working with. There are some outliers on that graph, which is really interesting. On the downside, there are two outliers. One of them is an election year, and it was 2008. We've spent a great deal of time on this show talking about what happened in 2008, so that makes sense. The other downside outlier there, you can see there's a real dip in October, and then it kind of levels out and pops back up in December and January. That was, as one of your listeners noted in a note there, that was the flash crash of 1987. Yeah, had pretty much nothing to do with politics at all, if at all. And then the high side outlier there, of course, was the very famous year of 1982, where... nothing happened, really. So it's interesting to see, right? It's very interesting to see that analysis.
Lastly here, I want to ask you what you think the media gets wrong in reporting about the economy, particularly in these kind of the volatility of a presidential race. And it seems to me that one of the problems, I had an old professor who would say, you know, stop reporting on what people say and reporting on what happens. Report on what people do. You could say the same for the market. You could say, well, this person says this is going to crash, and this person says gas is going to do this. And if all you do is just play those sound bites, it just brings a lot of fear and anxiety into the picture without the context that, for example, you provide in this kind of an analysis. What do you see the media getting wrong that you'd like to see change?
Well, I appreciate you identifying that about my analysis. The point of this was to sort through the noise and get rid of the projections and the predictions, forecasters, you know how I feel about forecasting. There's two types of forecasters, those who don't know and those who don't know they don't know. The second kind is far worse than the first. I'm the first. I don't know. But I can look back and look at history. And as Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. So we look at this in terms of trying to inform ourselves about what has been the case in the past. You know, I think that the press, the media, I think that it certainly does sell to cover the fear and negativity that people do perpetuate in order to get clicks and gain notoriety. You know, I don't want to criticize the press too much because they have a tough job. We've talked a little bit about some of my critiques in the past in terms of education and educating people. I am a former educator, and I would say once an educator, always an educator. So I would love to see more educational stuff out there. But the people that I'm reading all the time in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, different local outlets, I read The Beacon, which is a local publication here, I read City Magazine, great stuff. I mean, they're doing a great job. And, you know, my heart goes out to them for trying to work with all the different information and mediums that we have to deal with today in terms of social media and having, you know, such a short amount of people's attention span to be able to have a quick hit on things. I would like to see more longer form journalism. You know, if there were 45 minute to an hour interviews on the public radio station where people could really speak about issues in more depth, that would be really helpful.
More platforms like this?
That's right.
There you go.
That's right.
Okay. Last question. I know you're a big, as you said, a Bitcoin fan. Why has Bitcoin Cash lagged Bitcoin? Why can't it keep up? This is not a serious question. Ethereum or Litecoin?
Oh boy,
also not a serious.
You know,
question.
Next show. Let's talk about when we'll have a crypto summit.
A little crypto summit.
Yeah.
Eric Morris, where do you want it? Well, first of all, we'll post the piece.
Sure.
But where do people find you at work typically, Eric?
Yeah, I'm at alescoadvisors.com. It's A-L-E-S-C-O advisors.com. And you can click on my bio or click on my blog, which is the water wheel at the top of the page there, and find out a little bit more about my analysis and more about what we do at Alesco Advisors.
Dr. Morris is an economist at Alesco Advisors and a frequent guest here, helping us see the world a little bit more clearly on the economic side. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan, for having me.
From the whole team at Connections, thank you for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.